Your weekly pulse on the Milwaukee Bucks, straight from a Bucks legend. This is Here District with Marcus Johnson, alongside his son and 1995 NCAA champion, Chris. Here's MJ.
All right, welcome everybody. Here District, it is the Fantastic Voyage, and I am your captain of this vessel, Marcus Johnson, joined by my son, Chris Johnson. We are the only father and son combination in the history of college basketball to win a national championship at the same school. Nobody else has done that. There have been guys that have won them, Scott May and Sean May and Henry Bibby and Mike Bibby, you know, different schools. But no one has ever won it at the same school, which brings me to our guest that I'm really, really excited about having. And I've got the chance to know him over the last 11 years during my work with the Milwaukee Bucks. He's always a presence in Milwaukee, one of the most popular Bucks of all times. It says an Ohio State, but I'm going to say the Ohio State. He's from the Ohio State. He's a legend, Olympic gold medalist, the Hall of Fame inductee. And Michael, you love this. It says here in my note sheet, Dylan Carter says that one of the sweetest shooters of his generation, Michael Redman. Thank you for joining the Here District.
Oh, legend. Thank you so much. I don't even call you Marcus anymore. I just call you legend. And Chris, good to see you too, buddy.
I appreciate that. So listen, I talked about me and Chris. So Chris and I we played at the same college, UCLA, 20 years apart, but we also played at the same high school, Crenshaw High School in LA, for the same coach, if you can believe that, Willie West. Wow. In his second year when I got there, and about his 34th or 35th year by the time Chris rolled around and played for him. So you and your dad, James, played at West Columbus High School, right? I mean, so now, well, tell me about James, Mr. Red, Pastor Red, you know, Reverend Red.
What
was he about? Was he legendary in Columbus? Give me some background on him.
He was. You know, the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree. And he certainly was a player in his time. All city, all district, honorable mention, all American, point guard or combo guard, and had an incredible, you know, legacy that I saw growing up as a kid. I used to see all the trophies in the house and all the awards, and you know, it was a true inspiration for me to live in that house to see what he had accomplished. It's funny though, Marcus and Chris, that he never really forced me to play basketball. It was just in front of me. And you kind of gravitate to what's in front of you. And he was always watching games and watching the NBA in particular. And I was right there with him, watching those games and seeing his trophies. And so that combination really inspired me to become in love with the game.
So now you say, you know, he didn't force you, but right. it was always present. Basketball, he's a lover of the sport like we all are. Mm-hmm. But in terms of just any pressure that you felt, following in footsteps and comparisons, and Chris could tell you. I mean, some of the coaches at Crenshaw, my other two sons that played at Crenshaw, they used to tell them, Josh and Mariah, you know, you don't jump like your daddy, but he can't shoot like you. But it was always there was always this constant kind of comparison going on. Did you have to go through any of that growing up? And if you did, how did it make you feel?
Yeah, for the majority of my young life, I was Wes Red's. My dad's nickname is Wes Red's son. Okay. And it was a privilege and it was a badge of honor, not only to be a PK, but also to be his son. So I never felt any pressure from outside sources. My dad never put pressure on me at all. Obviously, you got hecklers when you go to local gyms and to the playgrounds. You have those things. But for the most part, our games are two different games. But the one strand that we had was his ability to score, my ability to score. So but we had two different games, though.
One-on-ones, any memorable one-on-one battles? How were you when you first beat him? Did he play you again after you got him that first time? Chris likes to say that I never played him again, but I don't remember. I don't remember it like that. But go ahead. What's your story?
Epic. I think I was 12 when I beat him the first time. It was epic though. It was Westgate Park in Columbus, Ohio, and I never forget. It was a Saturday morning, and you know, I could never beat him, ever. And then finally it got lucky and beat him, and the floodgates opened. And, you know, at that moment, when you could beat your dad, you could feel like you need to conquer the world and beat anybody. Yeah. So I never forget that moment, though.
Yeah, look, my dad, Jeff, was 5'10", 5'11", playground guy.
Correct.
Playground, but he had all kind of tricks and all kind of scoops under your arm, all kind of tricks. But I couldn't beat him, Michael, until I was about 14, like going into my 10th grade year. But I would go in the house crying all the time. My mother would yell at my father, Jeff, let that boy beat you. No, I ain't going to let you. That's going to happen soon enough. I ain't going to let him beat me. You got to earn this.
Yeah, but you had
those moments. All right. Yeah.
Oh, crying, called my grandmother. Because you know, our dads had
called your grandmother. Your grandmother.
Oh yeah. Crying, upset, and what it was, and what your father did with you, and you know this, Chris, is challenging that competitive nature, right?
Yeah.
That mindset. Really, I played against grown men, you know, my whole young life, and so my dad did that strategically once to start playing.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mike. Quick story on MJ. He didn't let me beat him, and we played literally every day for about between the ages of 12 and 19, Mike.
Yeah.
He did not let me beat him until I was in college. I was a freshman in college, and literally the way I beat him, Mike, he was doing our games. He was doing our games on radio my freshman year at UCLA. Yeah. So we had a shoot around one morning. He was at the shoot around. You know, he had his regular clothes on, you know, some jeans, some tennis shoes or whatever. And then after the shoot around, I'm like, Dad, come out here, man. Let's get a couple of buckets in, you know? I think I might have scored, beat him 5-4 that day, but I had to catch him at work, Mike, to get a W. It was my first win I ever had. But that competitive nature you speak about, Mike, that shaped my whole life. Him not letting me win shaped me as a man.
100%. And you got a built-in excuse. Your dad's one of the greatest players ever play. So you're not the average dad that you're playing against all those years, right? So, you know, that's the nuance compared to other fathers who play their sons. So, but no, there's no question. My dad did the same thing and punished me and beat me up and wanted to see how bad I wanted it. And it challenged me. Yep. And once I can conquer that mountain, I feel like I can conquer any mountain.
And what was the pressure? So forget about basketball, but the PK, the preacher's kid.
Yeah.
And you hear different people talk about it's a different type of dynamic when you grow up and your father's a pastor, a reverend in the community. I mean, was there more pressure from that aspect than the basketball aspect in terms of how you had to be careful to live your life and feel like people are watching you under a microscope? I don't know. What was that like in Columbus?
I think it was, like I said earlier, Mark, it was a badge of honor. And we made no bones about how we grew up as far as our faith and our convictions. And there was, there was more reverence and respect for pastors and leaders of the community. My dad was not only a pastor, but he was a leader in the community as well and a father to other young men. So that was the dynamic that I grew up seeing, more so than being made fun of.
Yeah. 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 But I mean, did you ever get in trouble? You ever do something? I know you did. Don't let me say, did you ever?
Of course.
But okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, of course. Yeah. No question about it. I mean, behavior modification, is obviously a central thing, but at the end of the day, nobody's perfect and you're gonna make mistakes. I think the one thing that my parents did a great job of was that they, this thing called grace, right? And the ability to, you know, oversee and, you know, and realize that I was a young man trying to figure it out. Right. And still at 46 years old, still trying to figure it out every day. Right. So, it was a wonderful experience and obviously made mistakes in school and messed up in school and in the neighborhood and did things I shouldn't have been doing. And, punishments a little bit different for kids who grew up the way we grew up. So, but I learned quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. Now you talked about, moving on here to your game, and you talked about, you know, different lefties that you are fans of currently, but so one thing about your shot, I mean, you know, you didn't have it here like this kind of, you know, right. I mean, your shot was almost, you know, not like Jamal Wilkes like, but you kind of slang that thing, man. I mean, that's from what was there a story behind that in terms of how that came about? You, I mean, it's unique. It's a unique looking shot that served you well, but it's a unique looking shot. How did that come about?
You know, it's funny. It was organic to just how I played. No one ever tried to change my mechanics, ironically, through middle school, through high school, through college. No one. And I remember I had a coach in the NBA try to tinker with it a little bit. And he wanted me to, he was trying to compare me to Ray and how Ray shoots and his form, how perfect and pure his form is. And at the time, I was a number of points ahead of him in the scoring list in the NBA header spray. And I told the coach, I said, am I getting the job done, coach, with my form? And he couldn't help but laugh. I said, I mean, that's all that matters at the end of the day. You mentioned Silk Wilkes, right? Yeah. And one of the most unique shots in the history of the game. But, you know, no one ever really tried to change my shot because the results were what they were.
Yeah. Well, one of UCLA's assistant coaches, when Jamal Keith then was a freshman, they were like, coach, we got to change that shot. So coach said, yeah, okay, well, let me take a look at it. He watched him shoot. He knocked down about 12 in a row. It's like, yeah, we're not touching that shot. Change it for what? We're not touching that thing. But listen, so you get this storied career in high school. You go on to the Ohio State. Now, I didn't realize you led the conference in scoring as a freshman. I mean, you come in getting buckets on like 22 a game, man. Your team didn't win, but you came in, man. You hit the ground running. What was that experience? What do you attribute to you being so successful? Like right off the bat, that's hard to do. People don't understand that.
It's rarefied air, as you know. And credit to my coach, Coach O'Brien, who just threw me in the fire as a freshman.
Yeah,
I didn't know any better. I was playing 39 minutes a game, almost 40 minutes a game, mm-hmm. playing the whole game.
I saw that. That was crazy, too. I saw that.
I mean, the conditioning, you know. And our team, unbeknownst to me, half our team got kicked off the team before I got there. So we lost a lot of our veterans and a lot of our top players before I got there. So we were depleted as a team, and our record reflected that, obviously. But, like, I went in and, you know, you're facing double teams and triple teams as a freshman. And you learn quickly on how to think through the game. And it was a learning year for me. As well as I did as far as scoring the basketball, I had a lot to learn still and learning how to be a winning player, right? So that was something that I had to learn to become as well.
I had a couple of questions about just that season. You know, you finished 8-22 that year, but you as the freshman of the year averaged 22 a game. That's an interesting kind of dynamic, you know, the freshman being kind of like the lead dog on a major college level. How did that season in particular help you develop character and leadership? Because I know as a freshman, you were probably between a rock and a hard place. I know you had upperclassmen. I mean, just I can't fathom just the position you were in. I'm just kind of curious how you dealt with that as a young man, as a freshman, with all the success and the leadership aspect of it all.
Yeah, it got tested early, Chris, early in the season. My teammates, especially the upperclassmen, weren't too fond of the role I was put in. And there were some battles and scuffles and whatnot. But over time, they grew to respect me because they saw my work ethic. And really, I listened to them still in the midst of the individual success I was having. I was still acquiescing to their experience and their wisdom, right? And being one that walked in humility. So that gained a lot of credibility as well. And so from that point on, by the end of the year, we knew where my status was on the team.
And look, Mike, so I was nowhere near the level as you were as a freshman, but I did start as a 17-year-old freshman at UCLA against Notre Dame. I started another 7 games, averaged, I looked it up, like 12-7 over those 7 games. But because of the upperclassmen who had designs on being NBA players, and parents were complaining, I was getting some haterism from certain people. And so John Wooden called my father up late in the season and said, "Jeff, Marcus has done really well as a starter, but I'm a put him back on my bench and I'm gonna play my upperclassmen." And so my father said, "Well, coach, it's your team. You do what you want to do, but you're gonna lose with your upperclassmen." That's how my father talked to John Wooden. But did you have, when you went to practice, was there one guy that you can remember, man, you just dreaded? I got to go and deal with this knucklehead today. And I don't know how his attitude is going to be toward me. Are we going to have to fight? Are we going to, I'm going to have to take some verbal, you know, was there one guy that, or a couple of guys that maybe that you remember that just, you just dreaded just having to show up and, you know, just deal, not face it. I know, you know, you could deal with it, but just having to just face that.
Yeah. I think, there was one in particular, that was actually one of my greatest teammates, Carlos Davis, who challenged me from day one. We got into a scuffle the first day of training camp in the weight room. Mm-hmm. And he was a senior. I had looked up to Carlos. Yeah. I couldn't lift. I was weak as water. I couldn't lift the weight at all. But I had an air about me and a confidence about me. And it was just one of his roles of trying to humble me, you know. And I looked up to Carlos when I was in high school. He was an incredible player in high school. And so, really, really grew to appreciate his tough love sometimes. And he challenged me every day and, you know, helped me become the player I became. And, but no, we went at it for sure. And then obviously when Scooney Penn came the next year,
yeah,
we had tremendous success. And Scooney was instrumental in my career as well, as far as every day challenging me in practice. When you have success as a freshman and Big Ten freshman and an All-American and stuff, yeah, there's a little arrogance that comes, seeps in a little bit, and a little air. And so Scooney was always looking to ground me and understood the talent that I had, but kind of wanted to ground me as well. So those two stand out, Carlos Davis and Scooney Penn.
Yeah. Now was the tradition of Ohio State for you when you were in school there in 99, 2000, around that time period, but were you aware of the Jerry Lucases and John Havlicek and Larry Siegfrieds? Okay. So that was something that you guys were, I know the football aspect and Woody Hayes and how great that program was, but basketball, there was that level of tradition and living up to the greatness that had been established at the school.
For me, the history of the game was vital in our household. My dad made sure I knew all the great players that came before me. And what you're doing right now is nothing new. It may be more enhanced, but it's not new. And so the Kelvin Ramseys, the Clark Kelloggs, you go on and on and on. The great players that we had, Jimmy Jackson before me. Many great players, the Lucases, Havlicek's, Horniak's. I can go on and on and on. And
Alan Horniak, Chris, you don't know nothing about that. He was a lefty too, right? He was a lefty. Alan Horniak. All right.
Of course, yeah. Herb Williams. The legacy of the basketball program is rich at Ohio State, and so my dad made sure that I went in knowing that I'm standing on the shoulders of giants. And then I think that's an important aspect of being a great player, actually.
Yeah. So get to the Final Four. I mean, what was that feeling for you, the community? I mean, what was that like?
Yeah, it was fun, Marcus, because it was a team that was in purgatory for a number of years. And I got actually criticized for going to Ohio State because it was such a bad program at the time. And but as a local kid, I wanted to stay home and help revitalize the program rather than go somewhere else to build somewhere else. And obviously you understand that. So I wanted to stay home and help build that program up. Yeah. And we were able to do that. Obviously, I mentioned Scooney Penn earlier and a number of other great players that were with us. But I think at the time, it was the largest turnaround in NCAA history from being one of the worst teams.
Mike, what was Scooney came? Like, how did y'all make the Final Four after winning 8 games the year before? That's wild to me.
Yeah, it's magical. You know how the tournament is, Chris. Anything can happen. But we had won a tournament in Puerto Rico earlier that season. And that gave us all the confidence that we needed to kind of know that we had something special. Now, that offseason, after my freshman year, we were in the gym every day, all day, conditioning. Yes, sir. I mean, there's nothing like being the worst that can propel you and motivate you to become the best. And so we didn't want to be the laughingstock of college basketball, let alone the Big Ten. And so we were in the gym working, conditioning. Yeah. We were just determined and focused that whole year. And as the year went on, we started blowing teams out and particularly in the Big Ten. And we just knew we had something special. And then obviously, you know, this, the backcourt is special during tournament time. You got to have a great backcourt. Yeah. And Scooney and I were hot to trot throughout that whole tournament. And it was a phenomenal feeling, though. Phenomenal.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. And so tell these current athletes, man, the kind of stuff, when you say in that gym, putting in work, because they don't like I've been on Gil's Arena and they doubt that, you know, we put in the kind of work that they put in. But give us an example of just kind of the stuff you were doing, man, back in those days.
Yeah, I think you both know this. You got to be a little psychotic.
Yeah.
You got to be obsessed. You got to be rabid. I have an AU program. And I tell these kids, I say, you guys working hard? I say, okay, let me give you some examples of what working hard is. And so I used to work out 3 to 4 times a day.
Yeah,
that's just what I love to do. I wanted to be the best, and you can't be the best at anything unless you work at
it. Yeah, and track work. You're on the track at all?
Track,
you're
doing track conditioning. Okay. Oh, absolutely, absolutely. We were not going to be out conditioned.
Right.
You know this well, Marcus. That you know if you're fatigued, it makes you a coward right on the court.
Yeah.
And so you've got to be able to be in great shape to exceed great heights, and we did that, and that was a hallmark for us.
Yeah. Yeah. And it showed on the floor, man. Chris, you got something?
Appreciate you.
Well, no, just thinking about, you know, okay, your Ohio State situation, then the draft happens. You slide to 43. Now, I heard a story that you can verify it or not. A crazy story that, you know, you were disappointed on the slide. Mm-hmm. That you went 43, then you went out and like ran a bunch of hills and Timberlands, or you did something like that. Is that a true story? Break that down for me.
Urban legend. What was that?
The next day, me and Lawrence Funderburk, Marcus, you know Lawrence Funderburk, played with the Kings.
Lefty.
And he was at my draft party, and you know, obviously disappointed, but that's, you know, really. Overall, happy that I'm in the NBA. I'm drafted, right?
Yeah.
So not too many people get drafted. So I'm there. And the next day we went to the hills, and I ran the hills in Timberlands. And I was determined to come into camp in supreme shape. And I was crazy. I just was. Yeah. I was obsessed with wanting to get better. And plus I was motivated by knowing that I was better than most of the people that were drafted ahead of me, if not all of them.
Yeah.
So that was motivation, Mike? You sitting there drafting, seeing the names called out, and
it's like, yeah, right. Yeah. Wait till I see him. Yeah.
and that's inner confidence you got to have, right? That's just inner confidence you got to have. If you don't have that, you sink or swim in the NBA. So, you know, the confidence I had. And so I went out the next day, and I was determined to come into camp in great shape. And I knew what I was coming up against as far as what Ray and Lindsey Hunter and Tim Thomas and all these guys at my position. I better bring it every day. So that was my motivation, and obviously to prove the other 29 teams that they missed out.
And now I read back when you were talking about just being a lefty was difficult for guys to defend because they practiced against right-handers and practiced for right-handers. But quick story, I'm with the Bucks. We're playing against the Knicks. Had a young man named Sly Williams who went to Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. And I think out of Connecticut somewhere he grew up. But anyway, he's a lefty. And so Don Nelson had told us, don't let him go to the left. And everybody out there, he had this little deke right, and he gets you back left. And everybody got beat left. So finally he put me on. I'm like, I'm not getting beat left. First time he got the ball, he deked me right. I went all the way over there. He went left. Don Nelson was like, God dang it, MJ. But lefties were always Sly Williams, Chris. He gave us about 30 that game. He took everybody left. But that was an advantage for you, is what you feel like.
Oh, no question about it. You know, it's interesting too that the scouting report said don't let him go left. But I always went right. And for those who played against me, I always went right. And if you cut my right hand off, you was going right into my sweet spot, into the left side. So being ambidextrous and being able to go both ways, which my father taught me a long time ago when I was a kid, and being able to go both ways, be versatile with your game. And then I had a coach, a great coach in high school, Keith Neal. And Keith Neal used to tease me all the time in our training sessions. He said that he was a great player in his time, too. He used to call me a man of 1,000 moves. And I said, well, they called me a man with 1,001 moves. And that was our inside joke. And the purpose of that is to be able to be versatile with your game, having the defense off guard. And that's something I took pride in as far as even with the left hand.
Yeah. But that rookie year, I mean, is this a misprint? I'm reading where you played 6 games.
Yeah.
I mean, injury or just did not get on the court? I mean, what was George Karl? I know you guys had a loaded team. You got to the Eastern Conference Finals, but 6 games, Mike? What was happening with that? And how was that for you?
Honestly, it was one of the greatest years of my career because the first half of it, first of all, my contract was non-guaranteed. So to even get a guaranteed contract in January, I was grateful. Yeah. Back then, we didn't have the G League. We had the CBA. So you either made it as a second-round pick with the team or you went to the CBA. So I had inside information from the very beginning of training camp that I was going to stick around, but there was no guarantee. And then finally, my contract got guaranteed in January. So that first half of the year, I was on a non-guaranteed contract. So to have made the team, to go from, okay, I'm not playing, to like really embracing my role and as far as making these guys better in practice. So my mentality shift from being a complainer or someone who was disappointed. Hey, you're in the NBA. You made it. How do you stick? How do you stand out? And my role was to make Ray Allen better every day in practice. Every single day I went at him, challenged him, he challenged me. And I'll say this, Marcus, it was one of the greatest years of my career because I learned from all these great players. It was a situation where I was watching all my peers play, but I was sitting on the sideline, but they didn't have the education that I had. And so my learning curve was accelerated because I had great players on the team.
Yeah, and your career took off right after, like right around your, I mean, your third year, you had a solid year, 15 points a game. But then that, but you had a streak. I don't know if you were looking at this, Chris, of about one, two, three, four, about 6 years where you were like 22, 23, 25, 27, 23, 21.
A bucket.
I mean, man. I mean, what was that? I mean, was it a feeling that you had that you were ready to move into this upper echelon, or what was that about, being able to take that leap?
Well, anytime you see a name next to Marcus Johnson, as far as averaging per year, you're doing something right. And I would see it year by year. I'm like, I'm right with Marcus. Are you kidding me? I'm serious. I used to watch all that and pay attention to that stuff. And I was in rarefied air. I think the first year, I'm going to say this again, the first year was important because I took a little bit of Sam. I took a little bit of Big Dog. I took a little bit of Ray.
Yeah. Jeez.
A little bit of Lindsey Hunter, Tim Thomas. And I rolled it all into one player. And that was the advantage I had of being around those guys. I learned from all of them and professionalism. And so I took that and continued to evolve my game. And, you know, the thing I will say is George Karl gave me a tremendous, tremendous, boost in my career. He believed in me. Ernie Grunfeld, Larry Harris, upper management, Senator Cole. They were huge as far as supporting me. And they saw the work I put in. I was the first one at practice every day, and I was the last one to leave. Every day, non-negotiable.
Yeah,
Mike, how much did the professionalism aspect that you were able to learn from the vets, how important is that in a young NBA player's career? Like the players that learn that versus the players that don't learn that. Does that contribute to long-term success, you think?
No question. Your veterans shape your career. So I had Irvin Johnson. I had Lindsey Hunter. I had Kevin Ali. I had Ray Allen, Big Dog. I had great veterans, Darvin Ham, great Greg Foster, great veterans that would sit by me on the plane every day and tell me, young fella, you got a promising career, man. This is what you need to do on the court and off the court. And when you get that every day, so the veterans didn't even let me live downtown. I lived in Mequon my first 3 years, years. They said, you're not living downtown, young fella. We don't want you getting in trouble or doing anything you shouldn't be doing. Right?
Real? That's
and they made me move out there with them. And I did that. And so it taught me a lot. I used to watch how they used to handle their families, you know, and their kids, you know. So all that stuff was important as far as your development, to your point, Chris, as a professional. And so not knowing that I would wind up being in the face of the franchise for many years to come.
So you get named an Olympian. I mean, walk me through that, man. Just when you find out, did you have a clue that you were up for that? Were you pretty sure that you was going to be on the team? Was it somewhat of a surprise when you first found out? What was that about?
So in 2004, during the Olympics, they were calling my name out during the Olympics in 2004. Why is Michael Red on this team? And I was like at home, like blown away, like, wow. And so when 2005 came, Jerry Colangelo gave me a call and said, hey, you know, we want you on this team. We need you on this team from a shooting standpoint. And, you know, it wound up being obviously a dream come true. You knew it was inevitable, but like still to hear your name and to be picked and all of that was just incredible. And to be amongst the elite of the elite, it brought validation to my game.
Yeah. And so you guys, you were the redeem team. I think in 2004, they had Iverson and then some guys that lost two or three games at Puerto Rico and some other, I forget who they lost to, But how much pressure? Was there pressure, or was it just such a collection of talent that, you know, it was like, oh, this is inevitable. We go get this done. I mean, what was that mindset like? You're talk about basketball. Some of those guys on that team too. Some of the guys on that team.
For sure. Oh yeah, for sure. That team, obviously we just went to the Hall of Fame, and I think that team most would say we're not the greatest team. I don't really care about that. I think 92, I have deference to them. That 92 team was incredible. We may not be the greatest team. I think we're the most important team to USA basketball history. Yeah. We could have went either way after 2004. We could have went a negative way, or we could have went the positive way. And so to Jerry Colangelo's credit, Coach K's credit, they put a product team together of incredible talent, incredible character. And at that point, we were all egoless because we wanted to win. From Kobe to LeBron to Carmelo to D. Wade, Chris Paul, Dwight Howard, Tayshaun, on and on and on, Carlos Boozer, Chris Bosh. Incredible cast of characters, man. And we got the job done.
You know, going up against Kobe every day, obviously you learned, picked up things. What would you say was probably the most poignant or most important sort of tidbit you picked up from going against Kobe and being around him during the Redeemed Team experience?
Well, his work ethic is legendary. But I learned how funny he was. I had a front row seat to his life more than most, honestly. We were like brothers. I didn't see Kobe as someone I looked up to. I looked at him as a peer, and he looked at me as a peer. And so we saw each other at that level. I had a tremendous amount of respect for each other. But I learned quickly how what made him great. So long story short, we are having dinner. We don't go to bed till midnight. I get an epiphany with my trainer to get up in the morning, to lead by example, and get to the weight room. I get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and my trainer is sleepy. Like, you sure? I'm like, yeah, I want to be there early. Get there early and just lead. I get to the gym. Kobe was already there. He had been there since 4:45. He looked at I walked in the weight room, and I'm like, and he looked at me, he's like, where you been? I was like, sleep. It's 5 o'clock in the morning, brother. And he said, no, I've been here since 4:45, 4:30, whatever, getting it in. And there's levels. There's levels. Yeah. There's levels to work ethic. And he was obsessed with being great and being with him every day. Me and him, we used to go in the gym by ourselves and work out together with our trainers without the other teammates. So that was my guy, man. And I miss him.
Yeah, talk about that Papa Shot. That Papa Shot competition.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, what was that?
We were there for hours, man. We were sweating.
Hours, Mike?
Hours, Chris. Hours. The team had left. And Chris Bosh came back. Chris Bosh came back 2 hours later, saw me and Kobe going at it for hours.
Sweating, pouring down.
Listen,
who won
man,
the game?
You got
who
two
won?
Killers.
Who won?
Two killers.
Who?
God rest his soul. That would go to the grave with both of us. Or who won?
Okay. Fair.
So he's not here to obviously defend himself. But I'll say this much: that there was although it's funny. There was a tremendous amount of respect for each other because neither one of us wanted to quit and give up.
That's funny.
And, you know, at the time, you know, we had been together for 3 years. And so we just learned so much from each other during that time. But I tell you what, Marcus and Chris, it was one of the greatest times of my life athletically by far.
Yeah, you guys got locked in that zone, just couldn't get out.
Couldn't get out.
I mean, and that's what it's all about, man. But so let's take it to a young man, 30 years old, Giannis, who has a lot of those attributes that Kobe has. I've watched him, Mike, and you've watched him. But being up close and personal since he was 19, 20, and I thought maybe 17 points, 8 rebounds a game, sneaking to an all-star team or two would be a great career for him. And here's this dude, you know, 30, 14 rebounds, 12 rebounds, 60%. Your impressions of Giannis as you've watched him evolve over the years?
Yeah, just special. He's a one of one. We've never seen anything like him. I think he has a tremendous drive. He's motivated to be the best in the world. And he just happens to have unworldly physical attributes that have allowed him to do that. And when you combine the mind with the body and the athleticism and talent that he has, you have Giannis. So just incredibly impressed. My retirement ceremony was his rookie year. And so I met him when I came in for my retirement ceremony after retiring. He was in the locker room or in the gym, and I met him through Dave Babcock. And Dave Babcock said, this kid's going to be special. And we talked for a little bit. And just so proud of his career and what he's been able to do. And he's taken this thing to heights that we never thought we'd ever see.
Yeah. And another young man, and Ryan Rollins also. I mean, he's another guy that I saw, Mike, in training camp last year at the start of camp. And I went to Milt Newton, just like, man, who is this dude? Man, this dude, he's going to make this team. He's like, yeah, you like him? I was like, man, he looks like he feels like he belongs. But you know the feeling, man. Ryan Rollins is another guy that I think has really, really impressed people.
Yeah, I'm not surprised what he's doing this year. I saw it last year, to your point.
Yeah.
And obviously, we have a gift to see talent and odyssey talent. We know it when we see it. And he is fearless. And knows he belongs. And I see him as a major contributor throughout the rest of the year, and the sky's the limit for this kid. I can even see him as being an all-star having a really, really incredible future at that combo guard position.
Yeah, that's something to hear you say that. And it's interesting, Mike. Looking at your numbers, I mean, you never shot more than 6 threes a game. When you see guys shooting 11, 12 threes, averaging 11 and 12 threes a game, I mean, did you ever foresee the game evolving to this point?
No. No, you have to have an anomaly like Steph Curry come out of nowhere and do what he's done. Dame Lillard. So me and Dame Lillard had dinner the first year he got to Milwaukee. And him and I have dinner together, and he was sharing with me about how he shoots only 8 to 9 threes a game in Milwaukee. He's used to shooting 11 to 14 threes in Portland. But he looked at me like, man, I'm sorry, man. No, I'm sorry. I said, do you realize how many threes I shot a game? And he said, I apologize, man. And it was funny. And I, to your point, Marcus, I never shot more than six. So it's a different time, different game. I was talking to Steve Kerr about this not you know a while back, and he was like, Mike, you would have thrived in this era as far as being able to shoot the ball 13, 14, 15 times from three.
You're still a 38% shooter. I mean, you went over 40 a couple of times. I mean, you had a really, really, for your era, just a great three-point field goal percentage, you know? So, yeah.
Thank you.
So let's segue, man, into what you're doing now. Talk about what Michael Redd is doing now and how is the lessons you've learned and you know, all your experiences on and off the court, man. Just talk about what's going on with Michael Redd today.
Still helping people, helping companies. I became an angel investor 12, 13 years ago in businesses. I really found there was a lot of cross appeal between sports and business, from leadership to teamwork to the ability to grind, to pivot. There's a lot of cross-pollination between the athletic world and the business world. And so I just had a magnetic effect with entrepreneurs and start really, really going into coffee shops and hearing the psyches of these young leaders and whatnot. So I've been doing that for the last 13 years. I have my own investment firm. I have an AAU program as well with our foundation. I sit on a number of boards. So I've had my share of things to do since I've been retired from basketball. A lot of what I learned in basketball certainly helped me with what I'm doing in business and other things as well.
Well, look, man, you've really represented the game well, as they say.
Thank you, sir.
One of my favorite people, just watching your success and what you're doing and all the things you're involved in. And keep coming through Milwaukee, man. We love you. The people love you in Milwaukee, man. They still – you know, that's the thing about Milwaukee fans, and you can comment on this, Mike, quickly. I mean, just they remember you. They remember that, you know, you don't have to win a championship. You know, they just remember that you tried. You gave everything you had. Talk about those Milwaukee fans before we close here.
They're special. I made a commitment in 2005 not to go to Cleveland to play with LeBron and to stay in Milwaukee. Mm. And to me, that sealed our relationship with Milwaukee. I had a chance to go other places to play, but I wanted to stay in Milwaukee because I wanted to be loyal to the fan base and to the organization that believed in me before everybody else did. So when I go back to Ohio, the fans in Ohio can't stand that decision I made, but I'm here. It's all love, and they never forget that. As long as you play hard and commit, they'll support you forever.
Yeah, that's it, man. They support you forever. Look, man, we appreciate you, man, stopping by here, District. And like I said, continued success in everything you do. And I'll see you around the way. Michael Redd,
thank you, my brother.
Thank you. Appreciate you.
Appreciate you both. Thank you. Absolutely. Sure.